Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.
With us today is Troy Hunt. Troy is an Australian Microsoft Regional Director and Microsoft MVP for Developer Security. He's also the creator of Have I Been Pwned and speaks around the world on web security.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
So before we get started, would you just tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe how you got started?
Well, I guess in addition to what you just said, I think you said I'm Australian. People can probably hear that. I got started, I guess, in sort of my modern day career in terms of building stuff for the web back in about 95. I remember it was when I first year of university, first saw the web. And I went, wow, like this is awesome. You can view source on a web page and then create your own site. It's amazing. So I started building web apps in 1995 and things just sort of went from there. And at some point I kind of pivoted a little bit and went into the AppSec side of things. And yeah, now here I am today.
Awesome. Awesome. So what are you doing today?
Too much. I say too much. It's all good fun, but I'd like to see my family a little bit more. So it's a combination of things. So I'm still doing a lot of travel. That's one thing I'm cutting back on a lot. So I'm traveling a lot to do talks at conferences. So I'll be off to Europe again in a couple of weeks, talking at InfoSec EU in London, going to Norway and doing the NDC conferences there. I'm doing a lot of workshops on my travels as well. So I do a workshop called Hack Yourself First, where I either run them as part of conferences like NDC or I go and see organizations and spend a couple of days in there teaching developers how to break their things, which is good fun. Doing a lot of other sort of commercial talks. Got to spend a day at a bank tomorrow scaring people, which is fun. Yeah, I like scaring people. Still doing a lot of Pluralsight, writing a lot of courses there, running Have I Been Pwned, as you mentioned. That's been a particularly busy period the last few days because I've got some cool stuff in the pipeline there. And blogging. Yeah, trying to actually write blogs as well, because this was the whole sort of genesis of a lot of this. So I do like to keep up the blogging as well.
How did you first get interested in information security?
When I was seeing other people continually do it badly. So that the context there, and you mentioned earlier on my Hack Your Career talk, and I talk about this a bit in the Hack Your Career talk. The context for me was that I was working in a large enterprise. They were outsourcing everything in terms of the development work, and I had an architecture role, and I would just see people build things and it would come back and I'd just look at them and go, what are you thinking? Do you have no idea like what is going to go wrong as a result of this? And there's this one moment that just came to mind, which I think just epitomizes the problem, where we had some work done by some Chinese developers with a mobile app, and I grabbed this mobile app and I proxied my device through Fiddler, and I had a look at the API calls it was making. And long story short, one of these API calls was to some method called something like get users, and it did exactly what it sounds like it would do. It just pulled all the users and all their plain text passwords and everything back. And I emailed this guy and said, look, I just proxied my device through Fiddler, and here's everyone's accounts. And he said, look, that's okay. Our users don't use Fiddler. Okay, I see where the problem is here. So that's what really set me on this path.
With a focus on security, you do tend to talk about a lot of scary things that somebody could expose in their website pretty easily. How much responsibility would you say is on the typical developer to dig into security? I mean, it's a really, really deep topic with so many things that could trip somebody up and cause a security issue. So how deep should a normal developer get into it?
Well, you know, first of all, I think security is one of these things that's a shared responsibility, where we all have a little role to play, whether you're the developer or the architect or the testers, and frankly, all the way up to the top of the management chain in an organization. Yeah, you've all got a role to play in making sure these things are secure. And for developers, frankly, they're often where the rubber hits the road. I mean, they're the ones that are writing the code, which has the SQL injection vulnerability that still keep it at the number one position of the OWASP top 10 at the moment. You know, they have an enormously important role to play here. And I would obviously love to see people get better educated at what solid, good, secure coding practices are. And frankly, with my biased interest in terms of creating training material, that's like the best possible bang for your buck as well as an organization. You know, it's not the firewalls and the expensive penetration tests and all the stuff that comes after the bad code's written. It's the stuff that helps you avoid the problem in the first place.
So you mentioned the OWASP top 10. Is that a short list of, like, if you don't know anything else about security, know these things and how to protect yourself against them?
Well, the OWASP top 10 is a great starting point. So it's content which is made for developers. And there's a really important nuance here as well. There's a lot of content out there from security pros that just speaks a different language. And that was, frankly, a large part of the reason why I started creating all this material. So the top 10 is very targeted towards developers. It explains, in a case like injection, which is actually a superset of SQL injection. SQL injection is one form injection, but it's probably the most common. So it'll say, hey, look, here's injection. These are the potential risks. This is the impact if it goes wrong. Here are the defensive patterns. And here's a whole bunch of resources that are useful. And they're in your language as a choice as well. Here's how to do it in PHP and ASP.NET and whatever else. So OWASP is a very easily consumable resource. And it certainly talks about the most fundamental risks. But of course, there's more than just 10 classes of risk out there we've got to deal with. And in fact, the OWASP just updated their top 10 late last year, and they dropped cross-site request forgery off that list, which doesn't mean it's gone away by any means. It just means, hey, there's other stuff that's even worse now. So the top 10 is like, start here and then keep going. But look, I guess humans like consumable lists that they can compartmentalize in their brains, and it actually does a very good job of that.
So one of the things that I kind of struggle with is, or have seen people struggle with is, you know, security tends to be, if it is even dealt with, which hopefully that is the case, but it sort of is ratcheted on at the end of the or sort of after the code. It's like, well, let's get this working first, and then let's make sure that it gets secured. Let's check for some of these OWASP, you know, some of the different types of vulnerabilities, you know. But is there some methodologies to kind of, or you know, frameworks of thinking, or kind of where are the approaches for actually developing securely kind of from the ground up? So when we're taking this whole thing on before we've written any sort of code, you know, we're going to take that secure approach.
Yeah, so don't do that. Like, don't wait till the end. And, you know, like, this is actually what really got me involved in security as well. Although I guess there were multiple different things, but one of the things was that in this corporate environment I was in, we would be waiting until the very end where all the code had been built. You're over time, you're over budget, and the product manager's breathing down your neck saying, where's my application? And then they'd go, oh, we should security test this, just make sure it's okay. And guess what? It's never okay. You know, there's always something. It turns out there's quite a few things when you always outsource to the lowest cost market as well, but that's another story. So, you know, leaving it till late is not smart for many different reasons. Now, you know, I mentioned one there, out of time, out of money. What tends to happen, and certainly this is very, very common as well, what tends to happen is you have a list of security deficiencies and they are prioritized, you know, the critical stuff and the severe stuff and the medium stuff. And you go down the list from the worst to the best until you run out of time and money, you know. And then the product manager signs off on the rest of them as an acceptable risk. So there's this person who, in our case, I used to work for Pfizer, the pharmaceutical company. So there's this person who all they're interested in doing is selling Viagra, and they're signing off on the CSRF risks. It's like there are things you know about, which we won't talk about here, and they are not CSRF. So, yeah, that's not a good position. And then we think about some of the sort of, I guess, immutable empirical evidence of software development and where it makes sense to fix defects. So many people probably heard or read of the Mythical Man Month, and one of the things they talk about there is the cost of defects over time. And the TLDR version is the longer you go from the point of writing the defect to the point of fixing it, the more expensive it becomes. If you can avoid writing this in the first place so you can get it right in the design, for example, it's going to be a lot cheaper than if you have to fix it in a testing phase. If you can fix it in a testing phase, it's cheaper than after it's already gone live. Now, I personally sometimes have trouble figuring out what it was I wrote yesterday and why I wrote it. You know, like I'll look back at yesterday's code and I go, what was I thinking then? If I can get that right to begin with, that is a really, really good ROI. So what we're trying to do, and we often sort of hear this term shift left, trying to shift security left in that software development lifecycle. Like let's fix it really, really early on. And that's partly why I say it's such a great ROI, the education piece.
So of those things that we're talking about the easy ones are like no plain text passwords and communications over HTTPS and things like that, or are we going farther than that?
Well, they're certainly part of it. I mean, the plain text password thing is very important. It's also something which really only becomes a problem once you get owned one way or another anyway. It's like, you had SQL injection, you're going to have a very bad day anyway. By the way, all your passwords are plain text. there's that. But there's so many sort of nuanced things these days in terms of the way vulnerabilities get exploited. Very often they're things like, look, you could be authenticated, but there is an endpoint somewhere which checks that you're an authenticated user, but doesn't actually check that you have access to the resource you're requesting. So yeah, you log on to, say, your bank account, and then you look at the number and go, oh, I wonder what would happen if I plus one. Someone else's bank account. Now, conversely, on the other side, another angle that's very interesting these days is that we have so many new security constructs built for the web, those things that browsers understand that people have never heard of before. So we have things like sub-resource integrity, the ability to hash a script and then load it from an external resource and make sure that it hasn't been modified. We've got content security policies. The XSS auditor built into Chrome can report violations back to an endpoint that you specify so you figure out when someone's exploiting XSS on your site. There's all of these really, really super cool things that people have just never heard of before, which are out there and can make a really fundamental difference to your security posture.
There was a Twitter conversation about a month ago or so when it came to light that T-Mobile Austria was having an issue with plain text passwords that seemed to have blown up around that time.
That was a funny one. I think I may have been a bit responsible for getting them into trouble there, and I don't apologize for that. There was, I think it was a girl who called up T-Mobile in Austria, and the discussion was something along the lines of, hey, T-Mobile, why can you see my password? It must be you're storing it in plain text. Now, in their defense, and it's not really defensible, however, all the other kids are doing it. You know, like a lot of telcos store your passwords in retrievable format. Virgin in the UK always gets pinged for this. I see constantly in my timeline people calling them on it. And they do it for customer service reasons, and it's not a good reason because there are better ways of doing it. But for the most part, the T-Mobile situation was business as usual on the internet. And what made it different was that whoever was behind that account started defending their position. And this really, like, this should be social media account management 101. Like, don't argue with the security people online. In fact, don't argue with anyone online. Like, if you're heading down that path, take it offline. But this account, I'm sure you guys can dig out the original tweet and share the notes, but it was stuff like the account was saying, but our security is really, really good, you know? And then at one point, I think the original girl sort of said, oh, you know, what happens if you have like an insider go rogue or something along those lines? The account was like, are you threatening us? And I look at this going, you guys are like, I was going to say professional telco, but I might take back that first bit. You know, like you're a telco. You can't talk like this online because what's going to happen is you're going to get a bunch of free penetration tests. And guess what happened next? I got a bunch of free penetration tests. And there was all sorts of nasty stuff which was then discovered on T-Mobile. And this is just such a predictable pattern. You know, like a company stands up and is a bit belligerent about security online. The masses go wild. Company keeps defending their position. Company site goes offline. Yes. Fun times on the internet.
So is that kind of the premise on how Have I Been Pwned was started, or how did that come about?
Well, the original premise of Have I Been Pwned was really sort of split objectives. And part of the objective was to build a service which does what it does today. So aggregate data breaches together so you can search them because lots of people don't know how far they've been exposed. And the other part of it was I just like building stuff, you know, and I had some downtime and I was like, let's build something on Azure, you know, like I want to build some cool stuff on the cloud. And I don't just want it to be like some, you know, random hello world, like let's actually build something interesting. And that was a very important part of it, sort of 4.5 years ago when I originally did it. In fact, I had some downtime. I was traveling. I was in the Philippines. And I remember I was bored in a hotel room. And I was like, this will be fun. And then 4.5 years later, funnily enough, I was just thinking I've spent most of this weekend building new stuff. I'm doing a lot of stuff with Azure Functions at the moment. And I was having that feeling again. It's like, it's nice just to build stuff. So, it's just funny how it goes around.
Yeah, it seems to have kind of taken off. And how do you get the information that you get to facilitate that service? Are companies reaching out to you and just telling you, we had a breach, here's the data? Or how does that work?
Surprisingly enough, sometimes yes. So there's actually three data breaches in Have I Been Pwned that were self-submissions. So they're organizations reaching out saying, look, we got owned, here's the data. Now, look, a couple of these are pretty small. One of them is truckers gaming forum. And I think it was sort of run by a couple of young blokes who were just having a bit of fun with it and sort of didn't realize the ramifications of holding other people's data. One of them, though, is the Ethereum cryptocurrency forum. This is actually, serious stuff, the official forum. And they said, we got owned, here's the data. Most of the time, though, it comes from people who, I guess, support what I'm doing with Have I Been Pwned and come across data through various means. Now, very frequently they're trading it. So one of the things I've learned in running this service is that there's a really vibrant trading scene for data breaches. Now, that's sometimes traded in a monetary fashion. People pay for data. Very frequently it is just people exchanging it. And often I liken it to sort of baseball cards where someone will go, I got this person, who you got? And they'll go, all right, we'll swap this. And now we've got different things, except it's digital, so it just replicates, right? Like you still have the original version. So we've just seen this sort of massive influx of data breaches being distributed in the period I've been running Have I Been Pwned. I've certainly seen it uptick ginormously. And now that this is just sort of something that people share around the web.
That's crazy that you're actually getting data just freely given to you from people who have been breached.
Yeah, it is. And to be honest, like I often see people will tweet, say, after some major data breach, somewhere they'll tweet out and they go, company, you should give Troy Hunt the data for Have I Been Pwned. Now, to be honest, I would not be encouraging organizations to do that simply because it's one thing to have data illegally taken out of your system by someone who shouldn't have been there in the first place. It's another to sort of take your customer data and then hand it off to a third party, which ultimately is this Aussie bloke sitting on a few billion records. So I would not necessarily be encouraging that. I'll certainly support any organizations who do. And certainly in the case of one of those, I end up doing the breach notifications for them as well because I had the ability to actually send that number of emails. Let's say it was Yahoo. I don't think Yahoo's going to turn around tomorrow and go, Troy, here's the billion or 3 billion or however many Yahoo accounts it is now that got owned. Go for it. I don't think that's a good idea.
Well, they're already all owned, so.
Yeah, well, but there are degrees of owned as well, and it's the thing with Yahoo is that I've never seen this data anywhere. Like I've seen lots of people claim to have it and none of them have. But it's not like, say, Ashley Madison, where every single person who wants it can go and find that data in a few clicks. I mean, that data was designed to be distributed as far and wide as possible. Yahoo, whoever grabbed that, hypothetically the Russians, have held onto it very tightly and not redistributed it.
So, I mean, I guess this kind of brings up an interesting, like, who is going after your data? Who is it? And is it just people looking to collect it like baseball cards? I mean, obviously there's a great black market sort of people want to use your information to steal identities, to confirm other information that they have. But, you know, is it a large group of people? Is it a small group of people?
I think part of this in terms of those who might be redistributing data is there's a question about intent here. So, you know, what are people out to do? Are they out to cause damage to a company? Are they curious, or have they just become sort of a secondhand recipient of data? And frankly, most of the people I have discussions with are in that latter category. The earlier ones, it's uncomfortable because I don't particularly want to talk to people about illegal activities that they've been involved in. But by the same token, you know, now they're sitting on, say, a million records of customer data, and you kind of want those customers to know too. So it's a bit of an uncomfortable spot. Very typically, we talk about sort of three different levels of threat actor when we're talking about the defensive patterns for building systems. So we talk about level one being your hacktivist and your kids. And frankly, they worry me a lot because they don't have good reasons for what they do. They're very opportunistic. And for everyone who goes, oh, yeah, they're trying to change the world and do positive things, like, honestly, go and have a look at the amount of stuff that's done under the banner of hacktivism. It's just crazy. But, you know, they're kids. They're either kids or very, very young adults. And they don't have access to a particularly large amount of resources, but they are insidious little, I was going to say something maybe I shouldn't say on this podcast. I look at the way my kids want to get vindictive, and they're only 5 and 8, but they can be very creative. They've got lots of spare time because they don't have to go to work or do anything like this. So kids on the internet can be enormously effective at breaking into our things. Now, that's sort of level one. And then we go on to the next level, which would be criminals. So these are criminals in terms of monetary intent. So they are wanting to break in and steal credit cards, which they can sell, steal data breaches, which they can, you know, sell on the dark web or anywhere else. And they do have a sense of ROI. So they're saying, look, if I can get into this system, it has something of value, which I can then monetize. And the thing about ROI is that if we raise that investment component high enough, we make it hard enough to get in, well, then the ROI doesn't look any good and they move on. And then finally, we often talk about nation states. And now it's a very, very different ballgame because suddenly the amount of money involved is absolutely huge. The way you defend against an adversary like that is very different. And depending on what the sort of asset you have is, it may also be of no interest. If it's an e-commerce site, there might not be a lot of interest to, let's say, the Russians or the Chinese. If it's a messaging platform, very different.
So I guess you kind of have to take that into perspective when you're looking at what you're building and say when you're developing those strategies to secure and that.
Yeah, and I guess there's a bit of a threat modeling exercise too, right? We're saying, okay, we're building this stuff. Who do we need to be conscious of? Like, who do we have to worry about? And that's, you know, that's a probably pretty good exercise for everyone to go through.
So you mentioned that you were at Pfizer a while ago, and you since left and moved on and have made a pretty good career for yourself doing a lot of security consulting and talks and training. Do you want to tell us about how you decided to make that move or what that looked like for you?
Oh, yeah, they made it really easy. They got rid of me and three other people. But the longer story, and this was also in my Hack Your Career talk, and anyone who's interested in these talks, troyhunt.com/recorded-talks. They're pretty much all up there. So the longer story was I was becoming, I guess, a couple of different ways of looking at it. Number one, I became good as a developer, and that's when an organization says, hey, you're a good developer, you should stop doing that, you know, and you should go and manage people because that's how you progress, right? And I can hear everyone that's listening shaking, nodding their heads already because we go through. And there effectively wasn't any sense of technical career progression. It's like, if you want to move up in the world, you've got to stop being technical. Now, certainly hands-on technical. So that meant I was doing a lot of architecture stuff and dealing with the sorts of problems I mentioned before. So, you know, things like just continually bad quality security flaw riddled software, which was making things quite frustrating for me. So that was certainly part of it. The other side of things was I was getting a lot of traction with my independent life. So independent life then really meant loads of blogging, increasingly speaking, and Pluralsight. So I'd been writing Pluralsight courses. And the long and the short of it was that Pluralsight was becoming very successful. I was making a lot more money from Pluralsight than what I was going into an office doing a job I didn't enjoy. And I really wanted to get out of the place. And fortunately, they made four different jobs that were based in Australia but were looking after the Asia-Pac region redundant, primarily because we're here in sort of the most expensive country within the region. We're looking after the cheapest countries, and you had places like China growing very rapidly and places like Australia contracting. It just didn't make sense. So we got redundancies, which is fantastic because a redundancy, they actually pay you to leave. So I got a nice payout after being there for 15 years in total. And that gave me loads of flexibility to then go and do whatever I wanted to do. And you know, it turns out that the stuff I wanted to do is actually quite in demand as well. So it worked out very well.
So could you speak a little bit more about the Hack Your Career talk that you recently gave?
Yeah, well, look, a lot of the premise of the talk was to sort of say to people, having online identities is a smart career move. And in fact, I start off the talk by saying, look, here's the first blog post I ever wrote. This was when I was in Pfizer. This was 2009. I wrote this blog post. And that was literally the title of the blog post, online, How Online Identities Are Smart Career Moves. And my premise at the time was that I'd been interviewing people to hire them as developers, and I'd interview someone and they'd say, I'm awesome. Not me, but they themselves are awesome. And I'd sort of go, okay, yeah, sure you are. And they go, no, look at my CV. My CV says I'm awesome. So, all right, well, but you wrote it. Of course it says you're awesome. And then they'd say, oh, well, yeah, I've got references. Go and speak to my references. And I sort of go, well, but you chose the references. Like, you're going to choose people that are going to say you're awesome. And the thing that struck me was that it was very hard to kind of independently gauge who these people were. And I would be out there looking for, say, anything from a LinkedIn profile to a Stack Overflow account to contributions on GitHub or anything to sort of establish that this person is who they say they are. And usually I couldn't find anything at all. And frankly, part of the problem was a lot of the people I was hiring were in other parts of Asia too, and that they just had a different approach to being public and having social profiles. But my premise was that I would like to have a profile such that if I ever want to leave the organization I'm in, or if they ever want me to leave, which is, of course, eventually what happened, then I want to have this independence. And it's not something that you do overnight either. Like, you have to work away at this for years. So this is really what the talk is about. It's like, here are the things that you can do to start establishing a profile. And that may mean that it's going to give you independence one day. It may mean that when you go for another job, it's going to help you get that job. It may mean that you're going to get better access to people and information within your current job. And then you sort of choose how far you dial it up. You know, maybe it's just some code contributions and some Stack Overflow answers. Maybe you do what I did. You kind of choose.
Awesome. That kind of leads into one of the questions that we ask everyone. Is do you have some specific advice to people that are just getting started? And it sounds like it would be pretty close to that, but I'll let you elaborate.
Yeah, well, I guess part of it is go and have a look at that talk, because that's sort of very specifically designed to do this, you know, things for you to think about. And interestingly, lots of people have come and spoken to me after that talk and said, hey, like, I'm doing this now and it's making a really big difference. And I often see it referenced, which is very nice. I don't sort of get that feedback from most of my technical talks. So I think part of it as well is that you don't have to necessarily know the end goal. I certainly didn't know the end goal. I just went, look, this feels like the right thing to do now. It's just a blog. It's like, it's easy to go and get a free template. You pay Ghost Pro something like a fraction of a dollar a day and get yourself set up and running, and then just see where it leads you. And I've found that I tended to drift in different directions and I guess pivot, as they say, here and there. And I still do that today as well. I don't necessarily have an end goal or a plan. I'm just doing what feels right.
Do you have any upcoming talks? I think you mentioned a few.
Yeah, so I'll be speaking at NDC Oslo in June. I think it's around about the week of June 12, thereabouts. If you're listening to this after that, it was a great event. We all had a lot of fun, drank a lot of beer, good times. In terms of other things that are coming up, down the right-hand side of my blog, I have a list, which just made me think I should actually see what it is that I've committed to. So I tend to try and plan for the things that I sort of get prepared for the next thing and leave it at that. So in terms of what I would have coming up, then I've got the Fraud and Prevention Summit in Sydney in July. I'm going to a SailPoint conference in Sydney in in August. We've got NDC Australia also in Sydney in September. So we've taken NDC around the world. And a couple of other things that I'm committing to but haven't yet announced in other parts of the world. So I'm just trying to a bit carefully manage how much I do, when and where.
And then I know you're heavy Pluralsight contributor, and I think you mentioned that you might have something coming up.
So over the last 4 days, I think I've released one new course every day. So there's been a lot of stuff there. So in the chronology of things, the last one I released was a course about bug bounties for companies. So if you're a company and you're interested in getting involved in bug bounties, I recorded what they call a play-by-play course with a mate of mine called Casey Ellis. He started the company Bug Crowd. So that just went out a couple of days ago. And then during this week, we'll have one for researchers as well. So if you're interested in getting involved in finding bugs and then getting paid for it, there'll be a course coming out for you too. And then actually after that, the only Pluralsight stuff we have planned is I'm doing a quarterly course that's free in front of the paywall called Creating a Security-Centric Culture. And we just released one about dealing with shadow IT within the organization. And if you don't know what shadow IT is, you really should go and watch the course. In fact, I just got an email from them today going, hey, what are we going to do next? So I've got to think about that. And we're also planning to record another few play-by-plays when I'm in London in a couple of weeks' time. And I won't say what they are just yet because they haven't all been locked in, but hopefully by the time this goes out, we'll be getting close to having those courses live too.
And also, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, which course would you recommend to someone who's just getting started into security?
Right. So if you are an ASP.NET developer, my recommendation would be my first ever Pluralsight course, which is still my most popular course every single month and one of the most popular in the library. And it's called the OWASP Top 10 for ASP.NET Developers. And that was a late 2012 course, but it is still extremely relevant today. In fact, I'm scratching my head trying to think about what would not be relevant today. And that's why it keeps rating so well, actually. It all still works with today's stack. So that would be great. If you are not a .NET person, then there is an OWASP Top 10 Big Picture. Which is for the effort invested versus how much it was watched is also my number one course. And I think it's about an hour and a half, and that explains what the OWASP Top 10 is, what each of the risks are, why they're important, but doesn't get down into the code level. So it's a bit technology agnostic in that way. Oh, actually, and one other one. I'll give one other one a plug because this is really important today. In about Jan last year, I think it was, I pushed one out called What Every Developer Must Know About HTTPS. So HTTPS is massively important today. It is still underutilized. You need to get this happening because even next week, so we're still in May, so even later in May, there are changes coming to Chrome in particular where if you don't have HTTPS, it's going to start to get very embarrassing.
So other than Pluralsight and following you in your speaking engagements, how else might our listeners follow you?
Yeah, look, Twitter's probably my most prolific sort of channel. So find me at Troy Hunt on Twitter. And you can usually see what I'm doing there. But look, between at Troy Hunt and TroyHunt.com, you'll find everything you need.
Awesome. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Troy. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
No problems, guys.
Troy Hunt is an Australian Microsoft Regional Director and Microsoft MVP for Developer Security. He's also the creator of Have I Been Pwned and speaks around the world on web security.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I'm John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.